threat from terrorism is real, but we will overcome it.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And there's a certain irony in the way the president tried to reassure the nation on Sunday night, I think, reiterating what he has said in the past and also clinging to his own way of speaking about the group that has become the enemy that could define his presidency in the last months of his second term.
We will destroy ISIL and any other organization that tries to harm us. Our success won't depend on tough talk or abandoning our values or giving in to fear. That's what groups like ISIL are hoping for. Instead, we will prevail by being strong and smart, resilient and relentless.
Obama says ISIL. Most everyone else says ISIS. It seemed to betray a certain stubbornness as President Obama tried to find clarity on ISIL, ISIS, or Daesh. Is this a new chapter? Or has the president missed something and finds himself playing catch-up?
The terrorist threat has evolved into a new phase. As we've become better at preventing complex, multifaceted attacks like 9/11, terrorists turn to less complicated acts of violence, like the mass shootings that are all too common in our society. It is this type of attack that we saw at Fort Hood in 2009, in Chattanooga earlier this year, and now in San Bernardino.
Of course, Fort Hood was some time ago, and that would make this new phase not so new. What to do now? Not a lot. Airstrikes over Syria and Iraq couldn't have stopped the married couple in San Bernardino. Neither of them was on a watch list of any kind, which makes this statement puzzling.
There are several steps that Congress should take right away. To begin with, Congress should act to make sure no one on a no-fly list is able to buy a gun. What could possibly be the argument for allowing a terrorist suspect to buy a semi-automatic weapon?
It's hard to argue with that statement, but again, it relates more to the Paris attacks in November rather than the California attacks last week. As the president handed an issue to the Republicans, here's presidential candidate Marco Rubio.
People are scared not just because of these attacks, but because of a growing sense that we have a president that's completely overwhelmed by them. And this is a president that called them the JV when they first emerged, ISIS did. Then just on the eve of the Paris attacks, basically argued that they were being contained, called the attacks in Paris a setback, as opposed to a widespread terrorist attack that showed real progress on behalf of ISIS.
How much can the government do right now to defend against attacks like the one in California? And if it's not much, can the president's opponents say it's not enough without having to offer any alternatives? Scott Shane, national security reporter for The New York Times and author of the new book Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone, says the choices for the president are narrowing.
The president felt and his aides felt that he had to go out and say something because of the palpable fear that a lot of people have related to the San Bernardino attack. And this sort of pattern goes all the way back to 2009 when President Obama did not come out right away after the so-called underwear bomber tried to blow up that plane over Detroit on Christmas Day. And they, you know, came to believe that that was a mistake and that if the president doesn't sort of get out in front of the public on an occasion like this, the vacuum is filled often by his Republican critics. So he certainly tried to, he ran through the things the government is doing and tried to give a sense both of what the government's trying to do to prevent, to defeat ISIS and to prevent attacks like this. But he spent almost as much time talking about what he thought the government should not do, including sending large numbers of ground troops, invading Syria, invading another Muslim country. And, sort of discriminating against American Muslims, lumping all Muslims together with this married couple in California, which he said would make the problem much worse.
Do airstrikes have an impact on this kind of an attack? Your colleague David Sanger is quoting sources saying that the number of airstrikes after 9/11 was far greater than the number of airstrikes that have been conducted in the last 16 months, and that may have some sort of impact on this particular attack. What do you think?
Well, I mean, the idea that there's a relationship between airstrikes in Syria and Iraq on the one hand and the attack in California on the other hand, I think that's a real stretch. There's no evidence of a connection between ISIS, the Islamic State, in its sort of headquarters in Syria on the one hand, and this couple in California on the other hand. The only connection there is that the wife in this couple posted on Facebook about the time they began the attack that, you know, she was swearing her allegiance to the head of the Islamic State. But it appears to be so far not a, a situation where ISIS, you know, sort of had command and control and told these guys what to do, when to attack, but rather a sort of long-distance radicalization where they were on the internet reading about the Islamic State, reading about ISIS, and taking matters into their own hands. So it's hard to connect airstrikes in Syria, or anything, in fact, in Syria with this attack. The other thing that complicates matters is that President Obama took a lot of heat for saying previously that he believed that ISIS was contained in Syria and Iraq. The fact is that in terms of seizing territory, everybody remembers that ISIS was sort of on a roll in 2014 grabbing territory. And in that sense, they have been contained and even driven out of a couple of cities. The problem is the relationship between that and terrorist attacks of this kind is not always what you might expect. Terrorism is a weapon of the weak. And if the United States and its allies pound the headquarters of ISIS and essentially drive them underground, take away this notion that they're building a successful state there, it's quite plausible that some of their supporters will react by lashing out with their own terrorist attacks in places like California. So it's not necessarily that if we take a tougher approach and are more militarily successful in Syria, that we'll be able to eliminate all these attacks, certainly in the short run.
Which suggests the White House is faced with two really undesirable options. One would be to concede territorial gains in Syria and Iraq for ISIS as a way of buying them off. Some have said that you know, this is what the Saudis have done all along with ISIS. And I'm wondering if we look at the biography of Tashfeen Malik, the spouse in this case, you referred to a moment ago, and you and the LA Times have done incredible work in trying to figure out what went on with her. She was in the United States on a K-1 visa, a spouse visa, and had spent time with her father in Saudi Arabia, where members of her family had suggested that she had become, if not radicalized, profoundly different in her approach to Islam and her approach to the world. Is there any discussion among sources that you talk to that this was a very long time coming sort of radicalization, that she might have been looking for a situation like this and that it had been years in the making?
I mean, that's speculation at this point, but that's certainly a possibility. Her history, both in Pakistan at a university where there's a lot of radicalism in the area, and in Saudi Arabia, you know, are both sort of clues that federal investigators are looking at. I don't think they really have any answers. One of the things that makes this difficult is that most people who carry out these kinds of attacks, you find, have spent months or in some cases years on the internet, sort of immersed in the world of Islamic radicalism. And you don't necessarily need to be in Pakistan or Saudi Arabia to pick this stuff up. As we saw, for example, in 2013 with the Boston Marathon bombers, those brothers, the Tsarnaev brothers, had you know, for the most part, been radicalized, it appears, online. So, you know, there's no necessity to track this back to Pakistan, to track it back to Saudi Arabia, because the internet puts this ideology and many of its proponents and supporters of ISIS, of the Islamic State, right there, you know, on your phone, on your laptop, for you to communicate with or you know, learn from every day.
Would you say that there's any sort of look at the K-1 visa process as a result of all this? Not particularly because of what happened with this woman, but it certainly is an area that doesn't get a whole lot of scrutiny. And with all the talk about refugees coming in from Syria, this is a place that, you know, lots and lots of people come in with almost no questions asked.
Well, the president last night actually misspoke and referred to the visa waiver program, said that this woman had come in on the visa waiver program.
Yeah, he's wrong.
Say, yeah. As you say, that was an error. But perhaps it underscores that there are a lot of ways to come into this country, and that is part of what this country is. And it's hard to imagine that you can stop every person with ill intent from from coming into the United States. Let's face it, in this country, we kill 14, 15, 16,000 people in murders every year, of which, the 14 killed in San Bernardino are about a tenth of 1%. So, we don't need to necessarily focus on immigrants coming to this country or visitors coming to this country to understand who poses a threat to our safety.
Finally, then, on that precise point, Scott, did the president miss an opportunity to talk about radicalization more broadly, because the Colorado Springs shootings took place just a week before the San Bernardino attacks, and that there are a variety of pathways to radicalization in the United States, as we well know?
Yeah, I think he made a couple of generic references to extremism, but in this case, he went a little farther than he has in the past and said that people in the Muslim community, while they should absolutely not be blamed for something a tiny number of Muslims do, they must confront, was his language, elements in the Muslim community who embrace radicalism, who embrace violence. But I think, probably the president felt that in this particular atmosphere, it was a bad time to refocus on the man who attacked a Planned Parenthood. And, it's interesting that experts who count these cases say that the number of deaths from attacks by radicalized Muslims, who sort of embrace jihadism, is just about the same since 9/11, has been just about the same since 9/11 as deaths from attacks by right-wingers, white supremacists, and anti-abortion protesters, and so on.
Scott Shane, national security reporter for our partner, The New York Times. He's author of the new book, Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. Scott, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.